It's April 15th, 2021. I'm hoping that everybody has mailed their taxes in. They are done with that. And now it's time to move on to some education. We've got Mike Weinstock on talking about end-of-life issues in an absolutely phenomenal and comprehensive segment that helps to clear up what some of this terminology means that we often get wrong. Mike, take it away.
After 25 years in emergency medicine, just last week, I had a situation I had never encountered. It was a patient who was no-code, and he was crashing. And while it was very clear he was going downhill and that there was a little bit of confusion, it certainly seemed like he was able to make his own decisions. And he said, "I don't want to be intubated." However, as he continued to spiral downhill, his wife arrived, who informed us that he had dementia. She was the power of attorney, though she didn't have paperwork at the time. It certainly was believable. And as the patient continued to decline, becoming hypoxemic and hypotensive, it was clear that at that point, he was not able to make his own medical decisions. This was a quandary at the bedside because I was faced with the extremely uncomfortable situation of having the wife, who was the power of attorney, watch as her husband decompensated and then subsequently died in front of her. So to help us understand some of these issues with not only this specific situation, but also other situations regarding DNR, comfort care, our perceptions, paramedic perceptions, is a physician who has published more on this than anyone else I am aware of. And so I'd like to welcome Fernando Murarchi. He's a attending emergency physician and the medical director of the emergency department at UPMC Hammett in Erie, Pennsylvania. So Fernando, thank you for taking your time and sharing your expertise with us.
Mike, and thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today and to help emergency medicine physicians really understand this issue.
So this issue is on the most basic scene, very easy, right? Patient is DNRCC. We're going to keep them comfortable, right? A patient is full code. I mean, none of us are refraining from coding a 18-year-old with a severe asthma attack, right? Or a patient who is a victim of trauma. However, at the margins, this can be a little bit different. So before we address that one specific situation, you have published extensively and you have a collection of trials, the Triad trials, in many journals, including emergency medicine journals. And I want to just sort of start with some of the things that you found based on your research. First is perceptions. How do we as emergency physicians understand code orders? And then we can extend that a little bit further. How do paramedics understand code orders?
So that is a great question. And first and foremost, the research is called TRIAD and stands for the Realistic Interpretation of Advanced Directives. And back when I first got involved in this work, it was by my own error. I made a mistake. And I was an intern at the time. I was taking care of a lady who was in her 50s. She was in VTAC from an MI. I'm in the ICU. I go running up to shocker, and essentially I have a nurse flashing a piece of paper in front of me saying, "She's a DNR. She's a DNR. Don't shock her. Don't shock her." You know, everybody doesn't have the safety net that I had at the time. I had a cardiologist literally who happened to be in the ICU, threw me aside, took old-fashioned paddles with gel and cream, shocked her. Back then, I'm old enough to say that we treated her with streptokinase and she went home. You know, had it been me alone there, she'd be dead. And what was flashing in front of me was a living will. A lot of what we get in medicine and emergency medicine is maybe little training or not the right training as far as what we need to do with these kind of documents. So as when we're supposed to know that they're effective versus when they're triggered or enacted documents. And effective means the document's just a valid legal piece of paper. It doesn't mean you follow it. It just means you have a discussion as far as what to do next. Whereas those documents, when they get enacted, they're triggered, meaning they're triggered by terminal conditions, persistent vegetative states, state of a permanent unconsciousness. And quite often at those times, we're not really at a point where we can enact those types of documents. So I think what's happening today is we try to do good with trying to prevent resuscitations in patients that don't want it. But the spillover is we've created so much confusion around this issue that we're under-treating certain patients and we're over-treating certain patients. And right now, we, emergency medicine, are going to be kind of dead in the middle of this because we're the people everybody sends them to.
Well, let me jump in right here because you made a pretty important statement there. We need to understand that. And I totally get it when you're up in, for example, the ICU or the floor, and you have this multidisciplinary panel come and the family's there and everyone knows what the wishes are. Maybe withdrawing care, for example, like your scenario where the patient had a living will but not the code status as far as shocking that patient, right? And the emergency department where we're forced to make a decision very quickly, oftentimes, for example, with the patient that I presented initially, which we will, again, go into a little bit more as we proceed through this discussion. So in 2015, in the Journal of Patient Safety, you published Triad 7, where you presented DNR paperwork to paramedics, and you found that there's a pretty significant variation in their understanding of that.
That was a statewide study that we did here in Pennsylvania involving emergency medicine personnel. We took pulse documents, the physician's order for life-sustaining treatment, and we took the variations that you can put together in pulse documents as far as the combinations of do not resuscitate orders with full treatment orders, limited orders, and comfort measure only orders. And then we put them into scenarios. And essentially, these are common everyday scenarios that medics would be called upon to pick up in private settings or skilled settings and essentially bring those patients into emergency departments. But what we did in that situation was we also prompted a critical change in the patient's condition and to see how that team would essentially respond to that patient with that type of a document. And we found it all over the place. So this perception that these are easy documents to follow and that medics can interpret these documents in and of themselves, it's really not evidence-based, and it's really the variations in responses actually follow the clinical practice we've saw and the variations in clinical outcomes. And essentially what we're doing is injecting confusion into the pre-hospital setting. Now, if a patient has an out-of-hospital do not resuscitate order and is dead, that's one thing. But if they have a do not resuscitate type of paperwork and it's not an out-of-hospital do not resuscitate order, and maybe it's just a pulse that has some DNR with variations in treatment, we really shouldn't be leaving that decision up to the medics alone to make a decision. We should really be making that decision in conjunction with medical command physicians so that they can essentially inject some additional knowledge into the situation to determine should we be resuscitating or not resuscitating that patient.
So you surveyed over 1,000 medics, and what you found was a pretty specific practice variation in their understanding of these life-sustaining treatment documents. A number of years ago, I had a patient who was coming through the double bay squad doors with chest compressions, and I sort of met the paramedics there and walked them back to one of our major medical resuscitation rooms. And while I was doing that, I noticed that the patient actually legit had a DNR bracelet on their wrist. And I asked the paramedics about it, and they said, well, we couldn't find the paperwork at the home, so we were legally obligated to code this patient. So give me some specific numbers as far as this practice understanding in the field. And then as far as that specific situation, what are your thoughts on that? And then we'll move on to emergency medicine physicians and clinicians' understandings of the life-sustaining paperwork.
When you take a look at just the different variations in orders, let's just say that no combination on that form was error-proof. And mind you, I call these errors. These are all medical errors in my mind because these essentially are treatment errors that happen as a result of some confusion of a document. But if you take a look at just the scenarios in and of themselves, if you had a patient that was in VFib from an MI, that was an everyday walkie-talkie patient, and they had a DNR full treatment order formatted on their pulse form, well, essentially, it results in almost a coin toss on whether or not that patient gets defibrillated in an outpatient setting, in the setting of VT and in the setting of an MI from a medic. And mind you, that's also the same that we've seen in emergency physicians as well as other physicians that we surveyed.
You know, those are astounding numbers that 50% of the time, even when they have the form in front of them, and the form that you're referring to is a Pennsylvania form, the Pennsylvania Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, the POLST form, P-O-L-S-T, that you were talking about. And every state or nationally have these different forms. But that's really astounding to me. 50% of the time, paramedics would do something different when faced with the exact same scenario.
Now, in taking that same situation with a living will, the actions are actually worse. If you put a living will into that scenario, it's about 60% of the time that they would not shock the individual patient and about 40% of the time that they would. So again, we're seeing errors regardless. I'll give you an example, the end of life combination that was supposed to be so that you get a patient who you make a DNR with comfort measures only when they're not in cardiac arrest. And we tell everybody that this is going to prevent this person from being over-resuscitated. Well, that's not true. The initial aspects of resuscitation range anywhere from 16 to 20% of the time. We're going to over-resuscitate that patient and keep them alive against their wish. Very similarly, the emergency medicine research that we did with physicians in those same combinations resulted in about similar percentages. So EM docs and EMS providers actually think very much the same when it comes to these kind of formatting of forms and how they would react to these forms when they get involved in clinical care.
So you mentioned EM physicians and clinicians, and Triad 6 was also a study you published in 2015, also in Journal of Patient Safety. You had 223 emergency physicians that responded. However, there was in this group also a pretty significant amount of practice variation when faced with the exact same scenarios.
Triad 6, the emergency physician study, was actually a study we did with the Pennsylvania ASAP membership. And essentially, now these are residency trained board certified people, so we figure they have much more of a high degree of accountability and education and training and so on. And again, if you took that patient who, you know, is a 60-year-old patient, I guess, with a DNR full treatment order in the setting of an MI, and, you know, who goes into VFib or VTAC in an arrest, 50% of the time they treat the patient. The other 50% of the time they don't treat the patient. So again, no matter what side of the coin you're on here, if you're an end of life guy or you're a right to life guy, somebody's getting it wrong, because it's the answer in their minds is somewhere directly in the middle.
I can give us a little bit of a break, and paramedics also, because oftentimes this is a emergent type of situation when we're making these decisions. However, your scenarios assume that everything is sort of perfect, sort of like an airline pilot type of thing, where you're actually seeing the paperwork and you actually have the specific scenario. So we're not even being forced to, you know, make a diagnosis of VFib. Not that it's very difficult necessarily, but even with that, in both of these groups, there's a very significant variation. So a lot of your publications started with this very first discussion, which actually was a case report in Journal of Emergency Medicine. And you asked the question, does a living will equal a DNR? Well, of course, we all know that it doesn't. However, it is so frequent, Fernando, that I ask patients, do you have a code status? And they say, yes, I have a living will. I mean, it's sort of like almost like in a funny way. Do you have diabetes? Yes, I have hypoglycemia. So I'll ask you one question and you're answering affirmatively that you have the exact opposite of that situation, right? But why don't you just give us like a bird's eye view? And of course, we all know this, but some of the differences or maybe some of the subtleties between living wills and DNR orders.
So just to step back a bit, you made the statement that we all know. We all don't know. When you take a look at the studies, right back from our original Triad 1 study, we showed really high error rates of people just assuming. They had these automatic assumptions that the living will formatted the way they're formatted equates with an automatic do not resuscitate order. Take that one step further. When I submitted that first study to JAMA way back when, the medical editors responded back, well, if that living will doesn't make the patient a DNR, I don't know what does. So, and the same premise followed through in all 12 Triad studies that we've done, in that physicians have this automatic assumption that the living will formatted the way it is equates with an automatic do not resuscitate order. And then to the same effect, physicians themselves have an understanding that the do not resuscitate order is an end of life order about 64 to 65% of the time. So we do have baseline misunderstandings across emergency medicine as well as all the other specialties of medicine. And many of those specialties of medicine have worse of an understanding. That same misunderstanding equates with nurses as well. Nurses have a perception that living wills are end-of-life orders about 80% of the time. Paramedics, about 90% of the time, when they see a living will, they think end-of-life. So we have these documents that we tell people to put in place to protect their decision, right? Even in wellness, but the actual operationalizing it all, these medical teams and providers have this assumption it means end of life. So we really need to fix the issue behind what's happening out there, as far as just because you create documents doesn't mean you're ready to die tomorrow. It means you did your job that we asked you to do to put your estate plan in place and your advanced directives in place. And we have to be better at learning how to interpret those documents as well as apply those documents in the clinical scenarios or clinical settings.
So here's how I look at it, and you can probably, with your knowledge, tell me that I've been doing it all wrong also. But just from a very basic sort of like, I like to think of myself like a, you know, as a fifth grader, right? Like from The Office, right? So I think of a living will more as when a patient is going to allow you to withdraw care later, whereas the code status is obviously if you're going to initiate that code in the first place. So I think it's great that patients have living will and you can say, hey, look, we can try to intubate you to chest compressions. And if we do resuscitate you, you aren't necessarily going to have to exist in a permanent vegetative state for the next several months with the 88-year-old spouse having to come every day and sit at the bedside for 10 hours. Basically, just saying that you're allowed to withdraw care if that initial action of coding that patient is not successful. Is that like, I mean, I know that's a very basic understanding of it, but to me, it seems like that's fairly primary. And it's surprising to me that the editors of JAMA, when you had, you know, submitted that paper, seems like they had a fundamental misunderstanding. As well, the scenario that you gave initially when the nurse ran out with the living will and told you that the patient shouldn't be shocked, but that was a fundamental misunderstanding also.
So I think a big issue comes behind verification of what orders actually mean, right? We live in such a dichotomous world, especially in the EMR today. You know, we got to check a box, and code status is often lumped into two boxes. It's lumped into a full code box or some DNR box. And it, like in your state, I think you have a couple other variations of it, right? You have a CC as well as a CCA order.
In Ohio.
So, I mean, it all varies and everybody's trying to check certain boxes. You know, there are patients that should be considered full code, right? There are patients that really should be end of life patients. And then you have a group that are in the middle that may want some degree of resuscitation before not becoming a DNR or may want no resuscitation for certain things. You know, the interesting thing is in Triad 12 that we released, which is actually we published a verification tool to essentially check and verify existing do not resuscitate and existing pulse orders. Even those patients that were DNR patients that were supposedly end of life patients, if they were afflicted with a critical condition that they could survive from and still have some degree of a quality of life thereafter, they still wanted to be resuscitated. You know, so again, we're not capturing correctly what patients want or need. And we've made lots of decisions over the years that have really impacted care and treatment that really have kind of flown under the radar. Now I want you to think about something. We've never really had to worry about wrongful prolongation of life before, right? I've often sat and lectured to this topic and tune and said, you know, if it comes down to me saving a life or letting it die, I'm going to save the life because I could always pull that tube later. Well, now we can get sued for wrongful prolongation of life to the tune of seven figures.
And you've actually been an expert witness with some of these cases where these lawsuits, which honestly, it's really sort of astounding that these occur on the surface. However, when you think of it from the patient's perspective, maybe it's not as surprising as you'd otherwise think. The fact that the patient expressed their wishes and that we are specifically going against those wishes. And I'm sure there are ways that we can justify our actions. Of course, we want to always default for saving that life. I'm glad that you pointed that out, that this could actually occur because it is something for us to be aware of. So before we get to that specific scenario that I discussed initially, because I really want to get your thoughts on it, what are some of the specific numbers from that Triad 12 study that you just had published in 2019, Journal of Patient Safety, titled, Are Patients Aware of and Agree with DNR or Pulsed Orders in Their Medical Records?
So what we found in that study is we designed a tool to go and check and verify existing do not resuscitate and existing pulsed orders that came into the institution. And essentially, we found about 25% of the time that patients or their appointed healthcare agent were actually unaware that the do not resuscitate order even existed. About 50% of the time, even though they had a do not resuscitate order, they had no idea of their prognosis. And about 40% of the time, those same patients themselves felt they weren't terminal. So what then transpired is about almost 50% of the time, it was like 44 to 46% of the time, the existing do not resuscitate and the existing pulsed order were actually discordant with the patient's wishes, and we had to change them back to full codes. Now, we also found a few that were full codes that actually really needed to be DNR with comfort measures only because they were really transitioning to end of life. But again, people just have this perception that you're supposed to follow things because they're existed already, right? And we're not involved in a large predominance of these conversations because they come in with these kind of orders, but we're supposed to follow them. And if you think about those kind of misunderstandings and us following without verifying, then we got a huge national patient safety problem that we really need to rectify here.
So let's take this right back to the beginning, and I'll just give you in 10 seconds or less my scenario of a crashing patient who is hypotensive, hypoxemic, who has some underlying dementia, who has told me that he does not want to be resuscitated and does have signed paperwork. However, the wife is at the bedside stating she's the power of attorney, saying that she wants him to be resuscitated. And I'll tell you what actually happened in this situation is that I chose to resuscitate the patient. I'm very happy for you to tell me that I did everything wrong, but I chose to do that. I intubated the patient. I put a central line in, gave the patient fluids, antibiotics, pressors. Just yesterday when I worked, I was told that the patient did, in the end, expire. So unfortunately, that was the outcome of it. But give me some sort of subtleties with this vast amount of knowledge you have based on these 12 triad studies. Would you have done the same thing? And I'm, again, happy for you to say that you wouldn't have. And is there anything that I could have done differently to best reflect this patient's wishes?
So first and foremost, I want to direct the listeners to our Triad 6 and Triad 7 studies and maybe an article that was published in Annals by Gene Abbott and essentially talking about our checklist that we utilized. And it's called the Resuscitation Safety Checklist, okay? And essentially, it follows our same ABCDs and that we train and teach people in ATLS and ACLS and so on. So when you're confronted with a situation like that, A is quickly asking that patient or agent what they mean by their directive, whether it's a MIDIO, whether it's a living will, whether it's a pulse, whether it's a Ohio DNR order. Ask them what they mean by it. What was their intention? Next is B, be clear. And you have to be clear to clarify, quite frankly, because that current condition may or may not be end stage. And if it's end stage, then you may be, have bona fide grounds to follow that patient's documentation. If it's really a critical illness, you really shouldn't be following the document, so to speak, at that point in time. You should be talking to the agent to get guidance because that's why they appointed an agent. The C in our checklist is really to communicate clearly. We have to communicate our medical diagnosis and our projected prognosis of that patient so that that agent can then make an educated decision as far as what they should be saying to resuscitate or not resuscitate in the form of tubes, lines, and so on. All right, so the D in our checklist is now really to discuss and designing the care plan. Now, in your particular patient, you opted to design the care plan to initially stabilize them based on her input, which is fine. So, in a situation like that, for example, you tell the agent or the spouse, look, this patient's critically ill. At this point in time, you're asking us to institute life-saving treatment, but maybe we should consider this for 48 to 72 hours. And if the treatments aren't working, then maybe we should start talking about de-escalating the care. And at that point in time, you're really setting up E in our checklist, which is, explaining what palliative care and hospice does. Because essentially at that point in time, when we talk about de-escalating care, look, we do a great job in emergency medicine and critical care as far as resuscitating people, but we do crappy jobs when it comes to the de-escalation process. And I think in that situation, folks in palliative care and hospice, that's what they're trained to do. They're trained to actually provide comfort, relieve anxiety, have conversations so that families could feel comfortable de-escalating the care in a way that they don't feel guilty about doing it.
So when I got to work yesterday, what they told me is that the patient was intubated, required multiple pressors, and then the wife, as well as additional family members, did decide at that point to withdraw care. So that was sort of like their living will-ish type of scenario that they said, look, there really isn't a chance for meaningful survival. They did withdraw care and the patient did expire. So that was the end of that patient. And it sounds like based on sort of that ABCD approach, maybe that is the way that it should have occurred because the patient's spouse, who was the designated power of attorney, when faced with some of the difficulties of the patient actually making that decision for himself because of the underlying dementia, hypoxemia, and hypotension, that it was okay to go ahead and be more aggressive and then to later withdraw care, which is exactly what happened. So, Fernando, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. You have more to share with us, and hopefully we'll get you back for a subsequent episode where we explore some subtleties as well as some other ways that we can actually understand the patient's wishes when we're at the bedside. So we will talk to you soon. Thanks again.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you for having me.